For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, we've got some top choices for your summer reading list. John Patrick McHugh discusses his hotly anticipated debut, Pure Gold, and being friends with Sally Rooney. Joanna Toy reveals what her shop girls have been up to as World War II draws to a close in The Victory Girls. And Arthur Turner shares his memoir about growing up as a blind child in the 1970s. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Sally Rooney, the author of Normal People, has called him one of the most exciting writers in Ireland today. And John Patrick McHugh is one of the few people that Rooney allows to see her own work before publication. Pure Gold is McHugh's debut collection of short stories, and it's a mesmerising exploration of betrayal and loss, set on a fictional island off the west coast of Ireland. John joined me from his home in Connemara. JP, welcome to Read On.
Thank you so much, Red. Pure Gold is my debut collection of short stories, and all the short stories are all set on a fictional island off the west coast of Ireland, off the coast of Mayo. So it's called quite simply The Island, and it's kind of partially based on my own childhood on Achill Island, a very real island off the coast of Mayo, and bits and pieces from other parts of Ireland where I grew up. So it really did come from my childhood summers and Christmases on Achill Island, but when I started writing, my own kind of gothic version of it came to the fore rather than the more idyllic and picturesque accolade of reality.
And it really does focus on that awkwardness of self-discovery and the ache of wanting to fit in that so many of us have during our adolescence.
Yeah. And again, it wasn't pre-planned. You know, I didn't write any of these stories thinking, oh, this is going to be about maybe someone stunted or someone caught in the middle of development or in an awkward position of their lives. But yeah, very quickly, all of my stories go to that place. I think, you know, the island in and of itself, by its very nature, an island is separated, it's isolated, and all kind of plays into that terrible feeling you have sometimes that you're being left behind or things are happening without your consent or something, you're out of the bigger picture. And I was always very fascinated by that. And I think very naturally, these stories felt more heightened once you're on the island, once you're dealing with those subject matters. A lot of boys who don't know what they're doing, but also like middle-aged people who feel a bit lost, you know, through grief or other things like that.
And there's also that sense of scrutiny of everybody knows everybody else's business and your grandfather and your aunt and uncle.
Yeah, completely. And as I said, I spent a lot of my time in Achill because my mother's from there. But I grew up as a child in small town Ireland in Cork, and everyone knew everybody there. And there's a nice aspect to that. And I don't want to make it seem too dark and depressing where everyone knows everybody. There is a nice side to it. But then there is also that side where shame is lived on every day because, you know, if you've done something wrong, they're going to know about it. Or if they perceive you've done something wrong, they're going to kind of let you know. So, yeah, it was something, again, without thinking, it came up naturally in my fiction just from how I was brought up and the environment I was in. And I was brought up in very lovely towns, but that sense of claustrophobia of everyone knowing your business was prevalent throughout.
And if you exaggerate a story, it can very easily come back and bite you when somebody finds out what the truth is.
Yeah, and I've actually gone back to Achill to see my nana once restrictions eased off here, and I had a couple of people asking about the book and stuff like that. But thankfully, they all know it's a fictional place up there.
The stories deal with characters of all ages on the island, but probably the most striking, and certainly those that we come across first in the collection of eight, deal with younger people. And there's a real sense of the ache to feel something. In the first story, for instance, Bonfire, we see two young pyromaniacs both dealing with intense personal grief, literally hurting themselves and causing damage to try and make sense of their ache. There's a real dislocation for many young people in these communities.
Yeah, and again, it's something I've lived through it, and then only afterwards you think about it a bit more. But the boys and the young girls that are in these stories, I've hung around with them, I've met with them, I'm friends with them.
We cleared everything out, and piece by crummy piece, stashed the bonfire inside. Thereafter, our foraging became instinctive. If one of us was away, the other still trawled the island with gamey hands, thieving anything that would burn. And when the evening shortened and the wind began to stiffen and bully, we dragged the bonfire out to the field. Terry tackled the big stuff, the tires and planks. I carried loose rotting wood and hay and the stacks of newspaper that I had spied unloved or on the back of Sweeney's. The field was tucked halfway between our houses, an uneven patch of buttercups, cloves and spongy mustard grass. From there you could see the roofs of Keel, the school, the water, the red beams of the bridge, and always you could hear the drone of cars cruising along the glen. We did everything in the field. Built traps for the wolves we hoped stalked us, sharpened swords out of handles of brooms, practiced our wrestling finishes, mine the steel choker, Terry's the hell's bells suplex. When it rained, which was often, we sat atop two paint buckets in our makeshift hut, a sheet of metal slantways against the neighbouring barbed wire fence. Our arms folded or slashing at legs eaten by bugs as we gawped at our world, being made momentarily unusable.
Glen Barry narrating Pure Gold, written by my guest, John Patrick McHugh.
Well, I feel like I'm probably the same in England, but in Ireland, it is that sense of wanting to feel something, but also not wanting to just express what you're feeling. That these two polar opposites, you have to kind of work in tandem where you don't want to discuss how sad you may be or how down you want to be, but you also want to strike out and get very drunk or start a fight. And again, just to be very technical about it, there's obviously, it's a great thing for a writer to look at these extreme emotions. But I was really, really conscious when I started looking at the themes of the collections, when these stories started taking shape, that I wanted to explore maybe the nastier sides of growing up, the sides that we almost forget about or sweep under, these kind of casual violences, not even the grandioso, he went mad and went after a couple of people, but the small little pains we inflict on each other and how sometimes we can't speak, but we act out. And in Bonfire, it was that very simple thing of one boy not being able to get over a bereavement and another boy not being able to get over his own exclusion due to social class and see what they would do. And in a very literal sense, they start a fire, you know? And it's just, I was always very fascinated by that and the interpersonal relationships that develop around when you can't really express the emotions, yet you act out.
And just breaking away from those labels or expectations that have been put on you by the community that you live in. The young lad who has been labelled as being of traveller stock will probably never escape that, but he still feels the need to try and challenge the way people perceive him.
Yeah, completely. And I think it may be a bit more prominent in recent years, but it is the unspoken disgrace that's going on in Ireland is how the travelling community is treated and how casually racism is deployed on them. And I was brought up in a very nice town, but the travellers were looked down upon as nothing. That's the truth. And I suppose Bonfire really came alive for me when I actually, because I was tiptoeing around that idea, when I actually just went straight at it and confronted what it was like to suddenly realize that if you put someone down, you feel better. That's the real power of that story for me is one boy, mild-mannered, nice, and he learns that if he puts down his friend, he feels a little bit better about where he is in the world.
And that is certainly something that is carried through in the second story, in Pure Gold, where almost as a self-defense mechanism, you're protagonist allows his friend to be hurt. And it is only by seeing the result of that that he is free to make his next move.
Yeah, completely. And again, the shame of one's own sexuality, but also, yeah, the release. Once you know you're not the one that's going to get in trouble, what that gives to you. And when you're that age, when you don't have that much power, those are the kind of things I always remember. Because I remember I moved around a lot as a kid, so I used to always have to meet and make new friends when I went to a new town. And anytime I joined a gang, you'd always realize it was like a Premier League football table, you know, who's at the top and who's at the bottom and who's in the middle. And those in the middle are usually the quieter ones. And then the ones at the top are the loudest who are able to just damn their friends if need be. And I was just, yeah, very interested in that. And Pure Gold is an example of that, about personal shame, but how you use that then to almost hurt someone else so you don't get hurt.
And these intense moments, these fragile moments where something can break or the trajectory of your life can change, can happen at any time. That's something that we see not just with your younger characters in this collection of short stories, something seemingly innocuous can lead to a situation that is going to be a touchstone for the rest of your life, or is going to push you in a different direction.
Yeah, completely, completely. And I don't want to give the impression it's just young lads causing a riot. But yeah, as you get a bit older, you kind of realize it's the small things that make the big difference in life, really. All the big decisions, they matter, of course, but it's the smaller ones that kind of usually have the lingering impact. And in both the stories where slightly older characters take center stage, it's these very small moments that just won't let go, that you can't move past. And obviously for short stories, they're the kind of moments that you love to zone in on, because you can really give it the attention they deserve. And I think I always find one of those tiny little moments the most interesting when it comes to people's lives and their love lives and the relationship with the wider community.
I certainly got the impression as I was reading these short stories, there was no way I could preempt how they were going to end up. And whilst they are beautifully plotted, I wonder if you allowed them to develop whilst you were writing them, if you always knew where they were going to end up.
No, I didn't. And I think the only good fiction can come when you kind of let the characters decide. Obviously, I know the setup and I knew beats that would happen, or I had some idea of where they would go. But quite often a character would do something that would completely throw me off course. And I feel like that's when fiction's at its best, when you're totally giving yourself to your characters and let them decide. So I'd usually have some idea, but very often I'd be thrown off course. For example, in How Your Horse, there's an incident where one of the characters headbutts a horse. I did not see that coming. I remember writing it and being like, what? You know, and then suddenly the story just opened up in a way that it wasn't going to go. And I feel like those unconscious decisions are probably when fiction's at its most exciting. And, you know, it's funny because when I've heard feedback for the book, and I've been very lucky, people have been very kind about it, but a lot of them says about, oh, the ending and how they shocked them and stuff like that. And it's just funny because I've obviously gone over these stories so many times. Mm. And I think the only reason they still maybe have that spark of shock in them is because I didn't decide for the characters. I more or less trusted them to make the right decision of where this was going to end.
Certainly in that story, How Your Horse, where a horse crashes a house party with both hysterically funny and rather disastrous consequences. It has that feeling of a drunken party where you're kind of wondering if you can make sense of what's going on. And alcohol is pretty central to most of these stories. It feels like it's very much the social lubricant for an enclosed community.
Yeah, and it is. I remember writing and I was aware a lot of these stories have alcohol in them, or they're kind of dominated by alcohol or abusing alcohol. But I feel like any other way I'd actually be lying, you know. And I, as much as I think Ireland's the 21st century and we've moved on quite a lot and a lot of issues, I still think alcohol defines how we interact with one another, especially romantically, even just in terms of how you get on in a community. If you're great crack in the pub, it does give you a boost. And we do have a destructive relationship with alcohol in the sense that we do always seem to go to excess. We never leave it off. We always push it to the next level. Now, sometimes that can be fun, but it is that I've seen it destroy lives. In my own family, alcohol has destroyed a life of an uncle and stuff like that. So it's something that I remember a bit nervy when I was halfway writing. So I was like, oh, there's a lot of booze in this. But I think I'd be lying, or I'd be pretending otherwise, if I didn't actually include the truth of what alcohol can do. I suppose I wanted to show both ways. You know, there's some characters there that have fun with alcohol, but then there's other characters that just are lying to themselves through alcohol, and seeing what that could do and what that tells us about Ireland today, really.
The book has wonderful quotes on it from both Sally Rooney and Roddy Doyle, and certainly the two stories that have been published elsewhere have garnered you a lot of praise and a lot of attention. Did you feel that there was pressure on this debut collection of short stories?
I suppose the pressure from myself, in that I wanted to be its very best, and I've worked on these stories since I was about 21, and not 21 anymore, so 8-9 years of work on these stories. So yeah, the only pressure was really from myself. You know, I suppose it's one thing I'm quite hard on myself when it comes to writing. I want to be best. I work harder every day. So I suppose that was where the pressure, it was more for myself. I wanted to make a book I could be proud of and also leave behind. I didn't want to have any regrets being like, well, that story could have been tighter or something like that. So I do feel I'm really happy with how Pure Gold turns out. And I originally sent it out maybe 4 years ago, and I got a nose off a lot of people. In a weird way, it was really demoralizing at the time, but in retrospect, this did me the world of good because it gave me a bit more time to work on these stories and polish them. So the only pressure I really feel is for myself. I've been very lucky with the blurbs. God bless Irish writers. But I don't feel any pressure to bring home any prizes or anything like that. As long as I feel the story's done, then that's when the pressure kind of stops.
And the arena you're playing in is crowded with some of the best writers in the English language. Both short stories and novel writing in Ireland have produced some amazing authors over the past couple of decades. Do you think that's got to do with the economic miracle that happened in the 1990s, or are there other factors at play here?
Yeah, I do think it's kind of amazing what Ireland's produced in the last 10, 15 years. It's kind of crazy when you consider our population size. Seems to be a famous novel every three. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe not even so much the rise of the Celtic Tiger. I suppose the crash is probably what has driven a lot of the fiction I see today anyway, or a lot of the writers I really love and respect. I feel like that kind of, I don't know, maybe it told us something about ourselves. You know, money didn't suit us. And in the crash, we kind of went back to maybe the arts in a way. It's funny because at the moment, I'm priced out of Dublin. A lot of my friends have been priced out of Dublin. So it's almost like it's gone back to those Celtic Tiger days where if you're young, you can't go to Dublin where a lot of the artists can meet and hang out and exchange work. So maybe it will go down again for the next 10 years. It might be a fall in the standards. But what I found was when I moved to Dublin, like 2015, 16, rent was pretty good. Everyone was around and you could exchange work. On a personal level, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the generosity of a lot of Irish writers who read stories of mine and encouraged me and published me. We have a really good literary magazine culture. And that's how like emerging writers get the confidence and the avenue to go forward and keep writing. I submitted to the Singing Fly since I was about 19. I got rejected year after year and I finally got in. And I went to a party they threw, and I remember just being introduced to writers, famous writers, and all of them were just encouragement. And Stinging Fly were always encouraging me to submit, encouraged me to write. Because, you know, writing obviously is a lonely business, but it can be a lot lonelier if you don't have a community helping you along, encouraging you, wanting to read your stuff.
Something I've read about you is that you are one of the very, very few people that Sally Rooney allows to read her work before publication. I take it it's a reciprocal deal and that you've let her look at your debut novel that I believe you're working on.
Yes, I feel very lucky. I think I'm probably one of five, and I'll keep that hopefully till the day I die. Yeah, me and Sally have been friends since we were about 23 and we've been exchanging work. So I've been reading her stuff before, conversation with friends, and ever since. And I've been lucky enough to offer anything advice on it. Like, to be honest about Sally, you don't really need to advise too much. It's already there every time I read it. And yeah, I send her stuff back and we kind of have a lovely relationship. And again, that was helped by Stinging Fly putting us in contact. But yeah, no, it's a real pleasure. Like, I got to read the new novel before everyone else. Stuff like that. It's a real perk of being a writer, I suppose. And yeah, I've only started picking away a novel in the last couple of weeks. So she's only read maybe one new thing. So hopefully there'll be many more things I'll be able to send her in the next couple of months. It's a lovely relationship to have. And yeah, I'm so delighted for all their success.
Now, the audiobook version of Pure Gold has been brought wonderfully to life by two fantastic narrators. Did you have anything to do with their selection?
Well, I had a small bit to do with their selection. I got sent along four or five would-be voice actors, and they're all amazing. It was quite surreal listening to these stories being read by other people because I've been so used to reading them aloud to myself. And the two gents that we picked are very good at the job. The only advice I had was to remember it wasn't inner city Dublin. It was Mayo, the west of Ireland. But I'm delighted with how it turned out.
That summer we lit fires, Terry and I. We'd meet in the mornings when oats still gummed my molars and the sky was beginning to shake itself blue. Two of us dressed in thready sleeve jerseys. Two of us decorated with scabs and cuts and small slowing burn holes. When we had money, we chucked it together and bought matches from Brett's newsagents. And when we had no spare coppers, the more likely, we snatched clickety lighters from the dashboards of Terry's dad's van or bummed fizzing matches from the backyard smokers of the clinic. Then, bodies gunned over the handlebars of our bikes, we'd thunder on in pursuit of fires, the island quaking from our shouts. Time had no use to us. Days never had acts, never dulled to a yawn, never became sticky. Rather, they were endless, borderless, buzzing alive until we were confronted by the full stop of night.
My favourite line in the short story collection is the one that opens 12 pubs. Eugene Mackeson had come to hate himself, which he guessed was inevitable when you hated the digits in your bank account, which I think shows the fun that you have had writing these short stories. Do you have a favourite story in the collection yourself?
I'm so glad, yeah, the fun comes across. And it's because anytime I describe Pure Gold, I'm always like, Jesus, this sounds like the most depressing piece of book. But there are lots of jokes in it. I had a ball in 12 pubs. I was laughing my head off every page. In terms of favourite story, I love them all equally, and they all mean something to me. But I suppose the last story, called A Short Story, I suppose I always say, if you like that story, then I'm very happy. And that's probably my favourite in the collection. I think it has everything I want to do in writing in one story. And I really wanted an ending that was cathartic, but also brought together all the other stories. I don't know if I'll ever go back to the island, but I want to leave the reader thinking, okay, I've seen the island now. Nothing was left behind, if you get me.
Well, you've certainly set a high standard for your follow-up and your debut novel, and I hope you'll come back onto the show to discuss them, but no pressure.
No, I will indeed, Red, and thank you again for having me on. It was a real pleasure.
Pure Gold, written by John Patrick McHugh and narrated by Glenn Barry and Aaron Hegarty, is available from the R&IB Talking Books Library. And John will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
This is an R&IB Talking Book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Enjoy your favourite Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Start your day with a morning adventure every weekday from 8 a.m.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
A book for the younger listener or young at heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
And our usual Talking Books slot every weekday at 2 p.m. Or if you prefer a book at bedtime, it's repeated at 10 p.m. And you'll find many episodes online at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show: Memories of Blind School and Medicine Head in Arthur Turner's autobiography, Out of Bounds. But first, over the last couple of years, Read On has been following the fortunes of the staff at Marlowe's, a fictitious department store in the Midlands, created by Joanna Toy in her Shop Girls at War series. The fifth book, The Victory Girls, finds Lily Collins and her colleagues helping the war effort from the home front, as Britain prepares for D-Day and Lily gets ready for her wedding.
Jo, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you so much.
The book begins at the start of 1944. Lily is just about to turn 18 and she's seriously considering whether she should join the WAF or the Wrens.
Yes, Lily in this book has a great dilemma. We've followed her through her teenage years and she's come to this crunch point where she's now old enough to join the services. She's really torn because she absolutely loves her job and she loves her chap, Jim. And if she went away, potentially she wouldn't have a job to come back to. What would it do to her relationship? She and Jim are unofficially engaged. But at the same time, she's got a great feeling that she should be doing more for her country. Her sense of duty is very strong. She doesn't know whether she's pulled towards the WAF, the Wrens, the ATS, but that dilemma for her really carries her through the book. And we're not sure, really, she's not sure how she's going to resolve it and try to sort of marry the two.
Her boss at Marlowe's can see that this is going to be a dilemma for her and tries to arrange a promotion for Lily, but that doesn't go quite as smoothly as everybody might have hoped either.
No, nothing goes smoothly in Lily's life. Having had a useful chat with her mum, Dora, who's a fount of wisdom, Lily decides that she can actually do her duty in Hinton and stay at Marlowe's and therefore be close to Jim. So she manages to reconcile these two. two extremes of going away or staying and still doing something good. But Miss Frobisher, her boss, is very, very keen for Lily to gain experience. She thinks Lily is a very good thing, which we all do, of course. But Lily's moved to a ground floor department from her much loved children's wear on the first floor. She doesn't find that she gets on quite so well with her colleagues. And the ground floor is a busier and a more surprising place than she had anticipated. And she actually runs up against a character who we've met before in books 1 and 2 of the Shop Girls series, because maybe it's my background in soap, but I love to bring back as sort of returning characters, ones that we've met before.
Lily is a extremely kind-hearted person and a natural problem solver. And that character, something has happened, and without giving any spoilers, she does need a helping hand, and Lily is there to try and make things better. And the book is suffused with kindness.
Thank you very much. I like to think the books are suffused with warmth and kindness. I think we need it particularly around us at the moment, want to wrap ourselves in it, really. As you say, Lily is a person who, you might say, jumps in with both feet. She's a bit of a fixer, but not, I hope, in an interfering way. She just always wants to make things better, and she can't bear to see anybody who is out of sorts or acting out of character that she can't understand, which is the case with this incident which she witnesses. So I hope that there is quite a lot of kind of problem solving that goes on in the book, and it's really to do with reaching out and caring and wanting to make things better.
The book is a great reminder to be thoughtful to your fellow human beings, that the war is coming back to Britain in the form of injured servicemen, and there's the third wave of evacuation. And we get to see people's natural reactions that can be suspicious, but actually the standout characters are the ones who step away from their initial reaction and think, what can I do to help?
Yeah, I think, again, because my background is in soap, these books started in 1941. And the reason for the name change in The Victory Girls is that I'm finally bringing them towards the end of the war. But there was, just as you say, this sort of sting in the tail of the war after D-Day. Along came, particularly for the southeast, the doodlebugs, the V1s, the V2s, which results in evacuees arriving in Hinton, my fictional Midland town. And Lily brilliantly sees a way to marry up two problems which she's got involved with and bring a solution. And I think we all like a solution, not too much of an easy one. It's difficult. You know, she has to carry Jim with her. She has to carry the various people involved with her. But I like to think also that Lily's matured and grown a bit through the course of the books, so that she's a little bit more sensitive about how exactly to intervene. It's a maturing of Lily, really, of all the characters. The same with Gladys and to an extent with Beryl, but Beryl will always be spiky and something of not exactly a rebel, but what shall we say, determined.
Certainly a sparky character.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good word.
And you mentioned Gladys, who is very heavily pregnant at the beginning of the book, and something untoward happens to her during birth that causes her to lose her sight temporarily.
That's right. Gladys has always been the quiet one of the three. Lily, spirited, Beryl, sparky. But this is really a huge story for Gladys. After she gives birth, her blood pressure drops dramatically. And it results in her actually going blind for a period of about 7 to 10 days. Something called cortical blindness. And I did base this on something that I was told and then read about, something that happened in the 1940s. I mean, I'm sure there are many, many more treatments and interventions nowadays which would stop such a thing from happening. But it's a huge thing for everybody in Hinton. Gladys's husband, Bill, is away at sea. One of the many reasons that Lily wanted to stay in Hinton was to be able to support Gladys, but she didn't for a moment imagine the sort of support that Gladys would need. So the idea of Gladys as a new mum, potentially not having her sight, is very, very shocking for everyone. And at that time, the doctors could not really give any prognosis. All they would be able to say was that, you know, it should come back. But of course, every day that passed was very, very difficult for everybody.
Gladys at least has the support structure around her, and fortunately the condition is temporary. We see other characters returning from the war with more permanent disabilities, and the awkwardness not just that they feel, but actually that people around them feel. And I think that's one of the things that we don't often think about with the Second World War. It was a great victory. And quite often the tens of thousands of men who were seriously injured and had life-changing disabilities are rather forgotten after the VE Day celebrations.
It's something that I just became very interested in. I think at the time there was nothing like the official support structures that exist now for our returning servicemen who, you know, might have come back from Afghanistan and Iraq in all sorts of ways, both mentally and physically affected. Really, the sort of help available was pretty basic. And as you say, it's a very difficult thing, I think, for somebody to accept when they had expected or been used to that person being fully able-bodied. It is sometimes as hard to be an onlooker as the person who is going through the trauma.
The book is also full of fantastic observations about just how strange life was during the austerity of the Second World War. I love hearing about things like Macon, the mutton version of bacon that sounds disgusting, and snook, which I'm very glad to say is a type of fish I've never had to eat. But one of the ways we see just how austere life is are the lengths to which Jim and Lily and their friends and family have to go to try and get a wedding organised. It really is almost as much of an achievement as D-Day itself.
It was. I mean, trying to organise a wedding was a military operation. There was very, very little available. Lily's mother, Dora, is a fantastic cook, but of course she doesn't have the ingredients. For some time now, white flour had been incredibly difficult to get, hence the advent of the infamous national loaf, which was like chewing a breakfast cereal packet, I gather, which was made with wholemeal flour, which we now know is terribly good for us, but of course was not the norm at the time. So trying to make a wedding cake was almost impossible. The story's a legion of people having fake icing made of cardboard. And Dora, Lily's mum, spends a lot of time trying to track down icing sugar. People used to contribute their coupons when there was a wedding or a celebration in a street or whatever, you know, we've got our community spirit again. People would give up some of their rations on the understanding that the same would be done for them when the celebration was in their family. So simply organising the food was a huge challenge. Of course, in Lily's family, they're quite fortunate because they do have a friend in Canada who sends over parcels containing all kinds of goodies, which are just unobtainable. I mean, even dried fruit was on ration. So they are better off than many, but the size of the parcels was limited during the later years of the war, so that there was this sense of equality for everybody. You couldn't have a parcel which weighed more than 5 pounds in weight delivered.
You clearly have loved writing this series and doing all the research and putting us all into the 1940s again. Is this really the final chapter?
I hope not. It's just been such fun to be with them. I mean, I reread the book again because I've written another one. So in a sense, no, it's not. The Victory Girls do move on. There will be another book out early next year. After four, I just felt I couldn't leave them. I'd originally thought I might be able to leave them after four. The fourth book ends at the Christmas of 1943. 43 had been quite a turning point in the war, in that Italy had surrendered and so on and so forth. But nobody knew at that point just how tough the Eastern Front was going to be, just how tough the Far Eastern Front was going to be. Or, you know, indeed that in Europe, the Nazi regime, the Axis as was, would mount such a strong defence.
It's great news that there is another book in the series. I've certainly been reading some of the reviews that have been posted online, and there was a bit of a clamour for it. I think the series has really come into its own during the last year and a bit of lockdown. It's been rather a good reality check for people who feel that nothing so terrible as the pandemic has ever happened before.
That's really been a very interesting response that people have had. I think, first of all, there's been a desire to be surrounded by something that is a bit warm and comforting. It sounds very strange to call the Second World War an escape, but exactly. At the same time, you feel that, well, this is tough what we're going through now, but we have been through worse. It was very, very different, of course, in the war. The whole business about going out and seeing people, if you're prepared to dodge the bombs and the blackout, there was no problem with that. So in many ways, it's been the reverse in the sense of the isolation that people have felt. But there is a kind of a resonance. And I think, you know, as a society, we'd got very used to being comfortable. Wars, even the wars we were involved in, tended to happen very far away. Of course, if you had loved ones involved, it was a very different matter. But something that actually came to our shores and invaded us was completely unknown to the British people. And it's been a very, very difficult time, I know, for so many people. You don't want to talk about blitz spirit, really. But there were times when everybody was queuing to get into supermarkets and that kind of thing, having street parties when we were released from lockdowns, that did evoke the time of the war. I mean, in a way, that's why we took a change of name for the Shop Girls as they approached VE Day, recognising that VJ Day was still a few months off. It just felt like they've been through a lot, you know. They deserve to take a breath and think, wow, we've got this far.
And the book again has been brought wonderfully to audiobook life by Becky Wright, who just inhabits those characters, doesn't she?
She's been such a brilliant, brilliant reader for the books. I feel so grateful to have her. And I absolutely trust her. Sometimes we've spoken before the recordings, but that's not always possible. And I just know that she will always get it pitch perfect, absolutely right. There are little gradations of accent. The books are set in the Midlands in my imaginary town, which is sort of roughly Birmingham, Wolverhampton way. And Lily and the other characters started off with, I would say, reasonably pronounced Midland accents. But Marlowe's, where they work, is quite a posh shop. So Lily and Beryl have a shop voice that they would use. And then at home, they're a little bit more relaxed. Equally, I've thrown all sorts of new characters into the mix with only a hint of where they come from. And I know I can absolutely trust Becky to get their accents and the whole pitch and tone of what they're saying and the pacing, absolutely right, which is crucial. It makes such a difference, doesn't it, when you're listening, as opposed to anybody who's able to pick up a book and read and imagine the voices for themselves. The reader is just so crucial.
It seemed as if the whole world was on the move and had chosen this particular day and this particular time to do it. The platform was seething with people. "Mind your backs!" bawled the porters. They were women doing a man's job thanks to the war, and they were good at it too, as they snaked through the crowd wheeling luggage. Khaki, navy and Air Force blue mingled with tweed or cloth coats and the occasional fur. Forage caps vied with Homburg's, Trilby's, and the velvet, felt and feathers of women's headwear. Cigarettes and jutting elbows were a constant hazard as people craned their necks and waved at travelling companions. Lily Collins gasped as she tripped over a suitcase and fell against a middle-aged man. "Excuse me," he said sarcastically. Alongside Lily, Jim Goodridge gave him a glare and took her arm. "So much for the age of chivalry."
Becky Wright, narrating The Victory Girls, written by my guest, Joanna Toy.
As you say, the sixth book is already written. When can we look forward to that being published as well?
Well, at the moment, that is penciled in for January next year, but I think we've all got a bit reluctant to look too far ahead. It should be at the end of January. It may slip a little bit, but I can give you a sneak preview, at least, of the title, which is going to be Wedding Bells for the Victory Girls.
Well, you heard it on Read On first. Joanna Toit, thank you so much for coming back onto the show and giving us the next chapter of the Shop Girls series. And best of luck with hitting that publication date.
Thank you very much indeed.
The Victory Girls joins the other four books in the Shop Girls series in the RNIB library, where you can also find a selection of Joanna Toit's Archer's Chronicles.
Hi, my name's Kim Jay and I'm a volunteer for RNIB. And I listen to the audiobooks quite a lot, so much so that I was listening to about 200 to 300 audiobooks a year, which I know sounds a lot, but it was a lifeline. And the thing is, when you're visually impaired, your world is small, it's tiny, it's isolated. Everything that you sort of want to do, you're constantly having to ask people for support and help. And that really does sort of knock your confidence, because you want to do things for yourself and on your own. And audiobooks are brilliant because you don't need the support of anyone. You can sit there and listen to them with your heart's content. Television is always difficult when you're visually impaired. I'm constantly asking people what's happened. You know, a text comes up on the screen, subtitles come up, and it is difficult. Now, the great thing with audiobooks is you don't need any of that. You can sit there and you can listen to an audiobook and you can follow the journey with the characters, and your imagination sparks up and you sort of fall in love with the characters and you go to places that you've never, ever been before. And all of a sudden, that tiny world of yours starts to get bigger and bigger. For me, it just makes me feel really happy and in control of sort of what's going on in my life. My favorite book, well, I've got so many, I listen to a lot, but one of my favorite is A Prayer for Owen Meany. And I love this book. It's by John Irving. It's a very heavy read. I think John Irving is very much like Thomas Hardy. Sort of, he's a modern American version of Thomas Hardy. And this book is set in America and it has an amazing twist. And for me, I followed the characters. I followed the journey of the characters. And when the twist came, I was so surprised. I had to sort of stop, rewind the disc, go back to the beginning, and listen to it all over again. And that's the great thing about audiobooks. You can do that. You can sort of backtrack and sort of listen to it all. For me, RNIB has such a vast library of different genres. And I read pretty much all throughout, from classics to crime to psychological thrillers. And yes, every so often the odd chick lit. And it really does sort of help me to kind of just get through the day sometimes, especially when things are hard and when things are tough. It's a great way just to sort of sit down, to listen to an audiobook and switch off, or even sort of listening to an audiobook when you're in the bath or cooking. There are even books in different languages, and it is well worth sitting down, ordering your book and listening to them.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, before we return to JP McHugh for the books of his life, here's Ellie Marsh to introduce our next guest.
Joining me today is Arthur Turner, who is the author of Out of Bounds, which was released earlier this year and is a warts and all autobiography account of the author's 20 years of home and school life. Born in North Shields, he was educated in a specialist boarding school for the blind in the 1960s and 70s. But enough from me. Arthur, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about what the book is about?
Yes, it's about my time at two schools for the blind and partially sighted. The first one being Royal Victoria School for the Blind, and the second place I went to was Worcester College for the Blind in the 70s. And it's about the sorts of things I got up to at those two institutions, because they're obviously residential, So we're talking about adventures, we're talking about misadventures, we're also talking about the way I was educated, the way that I learned Braille, the way that I learned maths. And I think in addition to that, there's the activities that we got involved in, because both schools were very good at sending us on various visits, well, as far as Benwell was concerned, in Newcastle, to various parts of the northeast, once the borderlands of Scotland. But Worcester, you know, we went hiking and went all over the country, really.
And how important was it for you, Arthur, to make sure that there was this sense of adventure in the book, and the fact that even though you were a partially sighted or a blind young person, a person going through school, that you still had these adventures and misadventures?
Well, I wanted to identify with as many people as I could, really, because the first school was a mixed gender school and the second one was single sex. And from the education, I didn't want to go into too much detail about that, because I just thought that if I sort of spruced it up with some of the things that I got on in the background, like not fooling around as such, but extracurricular activities, then I managed to actually weave in the way I learned things in with the adventures, if you see what I mean. But the first thing was at the primary school at Benwell, they had these running tracks, and they were like two blue bases, heavy metallic bases, at either end of what we called the boys' field. And they were separated by a wire, which wasn't barbed. And we could run with a bobbin down between those two points. I would say that it was about 100 yards in length. And that sort of gave me the confidence to actually sprint.
How important, Arthur, was it for you to write this book from your perspective and from a working class perspective as well, and hearing stories from people with sight loss like yourself from a working class background rather than a more privileged one?
Yeah, well, my dad was blue collar, so to speak. He worked in a factory, and I think his expectations for me were quite low, because in the 60s, when I was born, in North Tyneside, we had a home teacher who would come and see us every so often. And there was a, what they used to call a society for the blind, which you went to. Nobody thought that you'd sort of get to anywhere. We didn't have any resources. So I just thought I was lucky to get the education that I got. And Benwell managed to get me through what we called an entrance exam to get into Worcester, which from that, that was the springboard to get a really good education. Although I admit in the book, I don't pay particularly coherent attention to things all of the time because I'm growing up into a man, so to speak. And I'm distracted by music and women, basically. There weren't that many women at the school, but what there was, I was naturally quite attracted to.
Yeah. You mentioned music there. There's a lot of music in the book. Can you tell us why you decided to use music in the book and what it means to you?
Yeah, well, the music sort of generally, it comes from listening to rundowns of the top 30. And so most of us had radios at the college. The charts, for me, acted as memory reference points. And I could actually link positions and the movement of the records within the charts that moved this way or that way and or stayed still in given weeks. And it reminded me, there's a bit in the book where I learned about longitude and latitude in geography, and at the same time, One and One is One by Medicine Head climbed from number 6 to number 4. It's strange things like that, that sort of gelled in my memory.
So, Arthur, where can we find the book? Is it online?
Yes, it is. At the moment, there's a paperback, which perhaps many people won't be able to access, on Amazon. And there's a Kindle ebook on Amazon as well. Asked the question to the RNIB whether they would be prepared to do a Braille copy of it and put it into the reading services library. I've asked about that, and also provide a talking book, because I'm sure there's lots of people who don't know Braille and would like an audio version of the book. So I know some of the Kindles talk, but not all of us have Kindles.
Well, fingers crossed it'll be an audio version soon enough. We'll definitely keep everybody up to date with how it's going and when it's out, and people can listen to it, definitely from the RNIB library. But until then, thank you, Arthur, for talking to us and for telling us all about Out of Bounds.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ellie.
We know just how important reading can be for everyone, whether that's to keep you busy or just to put a smile on your face. The RNIB Reading Services online library is here for you. Register for an account at readingservices.rnib.org.uk and start reading straight away. Browse and download from our growing collection of over 30,000 talking books, newsagent titles and even sheet music on your smartphone, tablet, computer or other reading devices. RNIB Reading Services allows you to keep your books until you're finished and there's no need to renew. Get talking books in DAISY format. Enjoy a selection of e-braille books to work on an electronic braille display, such as the Orbit Reader 20. Search for RNIB Reading Services online or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and tell them you're interested in the Reading Services Library or any other of the great RNIB services we offer.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now it's back to John Patrick McHugh for the books of his life.
So, JP, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, there was one in particular, and I vividly remember it. It was called Mucking the Pig by Fergus Lyons. It was a little kid's book. I read it when I was like 5 or 6. It's about a pig that's been sold to the market to be slaughtered, but he thinks he's going to the market to get an ice cream and a hat. And I remember thinking this was the funniest thing I ever read in my life. It was beautiful drawings by Fergus as well. And I just remember reading that so vividly and laughing my head off and thinking, you know what, this is awful fun, isn't it? So Mucking the Pig by Fergus Lyons, that and the Beanos. I used to read the Beanos every week were the two things that I just remember laughing and thinking, wouldn't it be great if you got to do this every day?
Unfortunately, Mucking the Pig by Fergus Lyons isn't available in audio, but you can find it in paperback commercially.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yeah, on a rainy day, and I'm going to be very biased here because I am friends with the author, Normal People by Sally Rooney. I just think it's the most touching and lovely love story with also like commentary about society and class. But to me, it's just such a beautiful book, and it really brings you back to being a teenager and first loves and all that shenanigans. And I'm incredibly biased because I remember reading early drafts of that and just falling in love with Marianne and Connell. So yeah, Normal People by Sally Rooney. On a rainy day, I'd love to reread that.
She wears ugly, thick-soled flat shoes and doesn't put makeup on her face. People have said she doesn't shave her legs or anything. Connell once heard that she spilled chocolate ice cream on herself in the school lunchroom and then went into the girls' bathrooms and took off her blouse to wash it in the sink. That's a popular story about her. Everyone has heard it. If she wanted, she could make a big show of saying hello to Connell in school. "See you this afternoon," she could say in front of everyone. Undoubtedly, it would put him in an awkward position, which is the kind of thing she usually seems to enjoy. But she has never done it. "What were you talking to Miss Neary about today?" says Marianne.
"Oh, nothing. I don't know. Exams."
Marianne twists the spoon around inside the jar. "Does she fancy you or something?" Marianne says. Connell watches her moving the spoon. His ears still feel very hot.
"Why'd you say that?"
he says. "God, you're not having an affair with her, are you?"
"Obviously not. Do you think it's funny to joke about that?"
"Sorry," says Marianne. She has a focused expression, like she's looking through his eyes into the back of his head. "You're right, it's not funny," she says. "I'm sorry." He nods, looks around the room for a bit, digs the toe of his shoe into a groove between the tiles.
"Sometimes I feel like she does act kind of weird around me," he says, "but I wouldn't say that to people or anything."
Aoife McMahon narrating Normal People by Sally Rooney, which is available from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, there's one very strange book I read recently, and I'm not really a sci-fi guy, but I read this and I was like, wow, this is amazing. It's called The Hair Carpet Weavers. Now, and I'm definitely going to botch this name, so please bear with me. Andreas Eschbach, he's a German writer. It's basically a sci-fi soap opera. It's really, really clever, but it's also little mini stories about this kind of mad universe. But it's just really clever, really fun. It's really snappy. It reads like a thriller, if you can believe a thriller would be called The Hair Carpet Weavers. But it's about a society where people weave carpets out of hair. It took me completely by surprise because I'm not a sci-fi person, and yet I found myself devouring this book. I read it in about a day. It was so good. So if you can find this, I highly recommend it.
Sadly, The Hair Carpet Weavers by Andreas Echbach isn't available in audio. But here's a clip of one of the author's other books, Lord of All Things.
Hiroshi and his mother lived on the third floor of an apartment building across from the French embassy, where she worked in the laundry room. They had two rooms and a bath. Mother slept in the smaller room, while the other served as kitchen, dining room, and living room. Hiroshi's bed was behind a folding screen, along with a shelf where he kept his things. Over his bed was a narrow window with three panes of glass that he could slant open to let in the fresh air, when there was any. Here in the middle of Tokyo, the air wasn't fresh all year round. In summer, the nights were often so sticky and warm that Hiroshi couldn't sleep, and sometimes not even the rain helped him nod off. It was on just such a night that he saw the girl for the first time. A light silver rain fell, shimmering in the moonlight and the street lamps like a magic curtain. The flat smelled of the miso soup they'd had for dinner, and of the laundry strung across the room on a line, which was taking its time to dry. Hiroshi stood up and put his hand out the window to test whether it was beginning to cool down outside. It wasn't. He stood there for a while, looking down at the vast, dark embassy garden, unsure whether he was sleepy or not.
Nick Podal narrating Lord of All Things by Andreas Echbach, which is available commercially.
John Patrick McHugh, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Thanks again, Red.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can listen to us anytime by subscribing to your favourite podcast provider. Simply search for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sale, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to all my guests, to producer Hannah, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.